The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Burlington Northern Foundation. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music.
The amount of musical inspiration that has been killed by bad teaching and by putting children forcibly at violins and pianos is incalculable. It's a mistake always to assume the teaching is the stuffing of a poor goose, you know. It's something that must be a natural expression, as the expression on the face of a child, as the spontaneous reaching out of the hands.
Yehudi Menuhin says music must be a natural expression, and that ambitious parents may drive their child to practice blindly and deftly and futilely. I'm Lynn Farmer. This time on The Nature of Music, the topic is the performer. Pianist Emmanuel Axe says those little specks on paper are an imperfect way to transmit musical ideas. A young Japanese singer tries to find a balance between the strict tradition of northern Japanese folk music and her desire to express herself. And conductor Michael Tilson Thomas says the process of making music is recognizing yourself in the music and recognizing the music in you. But the making of a musician, says Menuhin, begins in the womb.
I think it begins with lullabies. It begins with hearing other people singing. It begins with the rhythm of one's own heart and pulse and movement and dancing. Actually, children react by movement already in the womb to music. And I think the preparation for music is not an artificial one. It's the music that's already within you that you are allowing to speak. You give it a voice, you allow the body to give it a rhythm, you allow the spirit to give it a melody, you allow the whole of yourself to give it the harmony of the parts. Just as the juggler becomes at one with his plates and his knives and whatever else, or the swordsman with his sword, or the rider with his horse, the violin becomes really and is an extension of one's own limbs. And as it's a vibrating body which one holds, with great delicacy and great flexibility, it vibrates in your hands and you sort of vibrate with it. Many people don't realize that when you hold the bow lightly, as you should, as it draws on the string, the vibrations of the string through the hair are transmitted to one's fingers. One is therefore holding all the time what is almost a living body, as of a little bird, you know. And very often, any brutality or clumsiness in the handling of an instrument, especially the violin, will deny you the subtlety of sensation. It's as with sympathy and compassion. You cannot understand another human being if you are all tied up yourself in knots and rigid. It's only when you are very subtle and sensitive that you can interpret someone else's emotions and pains and joys.
Emotions are our tools. My body, my experience, my emotions are my hammer and nails and saw, you know.
Singer Joan Morris and her husband, pianist William Bolcom.
There's a song by George and Ira called Isn't It a Pity? And in it, it's like regret because, wow, we're so right for each other. We're so perfect. But why couldn't this happen, you know, 10, 15 years ago? So many different things would have happened. Mm-hmm. And there you were doing all this dumb stuff. And there was I, you know, I was reading Schopenhauer, big deal. You know, that's really what the song's saying, just as I'm saying it to you. But what you have to convey somehow through those words is that it really is regret, you know. I wish we had met, you know, maybe...
There's so little time.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very touching thing. And if you can get, meantime, all the funny rhymes, that's one of my very favorite songs, because at the same time it's funny, because people will laugh at the funny rhymes, at the same time the sadness is overwhelming, and it's both at the same time.
The words to the verse are, why did I wander here and there and yonder, wasting precious time for no reason or rhyme? As I say those words, certain thoughts come into my mind. It reminds me of a situation where I was in, a guy I really, you know, I wished it had all happened earlier, maybe, you know, well, maybe I would have had kids. We don't have any children. I've never had any, but that's one of the things. And as I think that, you know, your thoughts bring out your emotions, I'll feel something. So when I get up on stage to do that song, I'll remember that guy. I'll remember how I felt, if I'm lucky. I mean, you can't force emotions.
Why did I wander here and there and yonder, wasting precious time for no reason or rhyme? Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a crime? My journey's ended, everything is splendid. Meeting you today has given me a wonderful idea. Here I stay.
Morris says sometimes she prepares a song by treating it like an acting exercise.
Say I'm saying it and nothing happens. Okay, I'll try it. I'll try it instead, like I'm Marlene Dietrich, and see what feeling that comes up. Why did I wander here and there and yonder, wasting precious time for no reason or rhyme?
Now that could also put you into a corner. So the opposite thing will be, okay, now do it like Minnie Mouse.
Why did I wander here and there and yonder, wasting precious time for no reason or rhyme?
Morris and Bolcom agree with Yehudi Menuhin that young musicians should be careful to avoid the trap of excessive imitation.
A person will have aped a recording,
mm-hmm.
and they'll have all the details, and they'll say, now this is what Barbara Streisand does in this note, and they'll ape it. That's almost like a verbal type of understanding.
You have to find out why you want to say those words, not imitate how somebody else says it, because you'll never get into the heart of it.
Just be an imitation Barbara Streisand, who's wonderful, but, you know.
People see the finished product, and then they sort of try to emulate the finished product and then go backwards, but the process leading to it is often hidden from the public or from the observer. I mean, who is it who looks at a painting who knows what went behind it in the painter's heart and soul and all, and the worry and the travail that preceded it? So the same with music. People get recordings today which are a finished product, the end result of a long period of preparation. And they emulate recordings without going through the process of rethinking and organic preparation. We don't follow with patience all the processes that lead to the achievements of the past and the present.
You'll find the essence of jazz exactly in that personal, organic process of finding your own expressive voice, according to jazz critic Martin Williams. In jazz,
you must not sound like anyone else, or you can't be a major musician. The major musician is the one who finds a way to sound most like himself and not like anyone else. But not, you know, that's a very narrow line to walk and simply, you know, not be eccentric and not be peculiar and not be egotistical musically, but do find a musical voice that's your own.
Jazz singer Betty Carter.
When I first came up in the business, I had a lot of great, great singers that was around me. There was Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, and Diana Washington. And these were top-notch singers. Ella Fitzgerald has recorded more songbooks of different composers. And these composers want her to kind of stay hanging there with the melody. She does not lag, so everybody expects from Ella Fitzgerald to sing the melody. And Sarah Vaughan, who came along a little later, did more with the melody than Ella Fitzgerald did. I'm not talking about scatting now. I'm only talking about songs, you know. So in order for me to be an individual, in order for me to be different, I worked my music around arrangements. I tried to educate myself in doing songs in different tempos, different meters, with an arrangement, with a change of keys, different attitudes, different approaches. Whenever the song was sang as a ballad, I would try to maybe take it and make a bounce song out of it or something like that. And maybe I would take some real risk and do something very fast. Like, for instance, the favorite things that I did in 1964 was very fast in 4/4. I took that risk. I took more risk when it came to arrangements than Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan. I could not, at that time, it was taboo for me to even think about being like those singers. So I had to become an individual, you see. So my idea was to take some more risk with my music and to sing the songs that most singers don't touch or have not been overdone, overexposed. I would reach out and find some songs that would be identified with Betty Carter.
Martin Williams says that, unlike Betty Carter, it's also possible for a musician with limited technique to become a major figure in jazz.
For instance, Thelonious Monk and Count Basie were both virtuosi of rhythm in this music, just beyond belief. But if you talk about them in terms of keyboard technique at the piano, you know, they threw away half what they knew. And you can prove that because their early records, they were all over the keyboard compared to the way they were later. And so to find themselves, they had to simplify themselves. But then on the other hand, you have musicians like, well, Miles Davis. Miles Davis was never, as one player put it, a hell of a trumpet player. And yet, by accepting his limitations and learning to make music within them, he became a major figure. Same would be true of a pianist like John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet. You know, I'm not giving any kind of populist definition of excellence here. I'm not evaluating the second rate in the interest of some kind of deluded idea of what democracy is, I hope. I don't mean that at all. You have to be a real musician of some kind to work in this music. You can't wish to be a musician and have some small talent and then and achieve any kind of greatness that way. It's not that kind of thing.
In the north of Japan, in the prefecture of Akita, there is an elaborate and exact style of folk singing, Akita Minyo. One of the great masters of Akita Minyo singing is Asano Umewaka. His disciples include a young woman, Sanae-san.
I am now, 6 years ago, when the teacher came to Osaka, その公演をたまたま見に行ってて、でその時そんな興味なかったんですけども、ああいいもんだなと思って、その時こうピンとこう来て、それでやるようになったんです。
I went once to a performance of Mr. Asano's in Osaka, and at the time before that performance, I didn't have a particular interest in Akita Minyo, but after I heard him sing something went off in my head, and I thought, oh, this is just wonderful. I would love to study it.
Sanae-san's teacher makes sure that she performs the song exactly the way he does.
He
wants to teach the exact way of singing a particular phrase. He says that it is set, and so first he wants the student to really learn the accurate way of singing it.
But what does Sanae-san think of simply reproducing exactly what her teacher sings? Does she ever think of expressing her own style?
So you funny sleba, yapari, utaga kawachande. So you go to a night.
No, if I think that I should have my own individual way of expressing myself, then the songs will start to change, and that would not be proper, so no.
Asano sensei has another student, Yoshie-san. She's a native of Akita herself, but she has no intention of conforming totally to her teacher's style.
やっぱり人それぞれ生まれたところも違うし、そこまで来た生活ももちろん違うわけだから、歌ってみてある程度のいいところはもちろん先生から盗むっていうか、先生のいいところをたくさん取って、それでその後自分が例えばこう先生からこう独立して一つの
Well, it's true after all that we're born in different times and in different circumstances. We have different life experiences. And so while it is though I am almost stealing the best of what Mr. Asano has to teach, how he sings, I'm learning so much from him. I think it's true that eventually if I become a teacher myself someday and teach a group of people, that I should be singing in some sort of style that has a taste of my own life in it.
Hi.
Japanese folk music from the northern prefecture of Akita, a tradition that passes from master to disciple orally. Many musics of the world, including Western classical, use little specks on a paper, notation, to help pass the tradition from one generation to the next. Just how do you make music out of those notes on a page? Pianist Emmanuel Axe.
Look, little specks on the paper are a guide to what is supposed to be heard. Music is not pages and notes that you hold in your hand. Music obviously is an experience that you hear in a period of time. So printed music is a way to transmit what the composer had in mind when he was writing it. It's a very imperfect way to transmit it.
Musicologist Leonard Meyer found an imperfect way to interpret some notation he came across.
I remember at one point I was trying to study American Indian music. And a lot of that music was collected by a woman named Frances Densmore, and it was on cylinders at the Library of Congress. Now, I had Frances Densmore's books, right, and they had musical examples in them, right? And I would read the musical examples, if you will, within the tradition of understanding Western music. And I would read something, and it would say, tee-dee-dee-dum, right? Finally, I got the discs. What that sounded like was, hoya, 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 right? I mean, I didn't understand the performance tradition, so to speak, for that kind of music.
It's the tradition you inherit. A man in, we said, 1550, let's say, would have been brought up to understand certain things by the pieces of music he would be playing or singing from. A man, even 50 years later, might certainly understand those differently. A man now looking at music of 1550 would understand them differently again.
Stanley Sadie, editor of the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. A man now trying to make music out of notes on a page first has to look within himself. Conductor Michael Tilson Thomas.
It's where any musician comes in. The process of making music is recognizing yourself in the piece of music and recognizing the piece of music in you. And in some place I come to a measure, and it says in instruction to this measure, it says, poco ritardando, go a little slower. It slows up a little bit. And then it says at the end of the measure, a tempo. So, of course, I can just go a little slower, and then I can go a tempo. But what I have to ask myself is, why am I being asked to go a little slower here? What is the point of this? Is the phrase stumbling to a point of uncertainty? Is it being dragged down to a kind of desperate full stop? Is it relaxing into a kind of sleepy torpor? Is it whimsically standing on one foot, wondering which way the path is to continue? And just exactly where is that slowing down beginning? And what is the slowest moment of it? And does it really come to a stop, or does it just come to a kind of little pause, like, not really stopping at a stop sign, but sort of what, like a rolling stop or something like that?
Pianist Emmanuel Axe says that you make decisions about every single note you play.
As soon as you put your hands on the keyboard, you're doing something. And this whole business of he just plays the notes is a meaningless remark. What you can say is he's just played a very boring performance. But to say he's just played the notes and had no individual touches is silly. Because everything you do is individual. Every time you touch the keyboard, you make a decision. Another perfect example is Maurizio Pollini. I mean, here's a man who plays the Hammerklavier Sonata, which I've heard him do in Carnegie Hall. I hear, with every note that he plays, I hear his personality. But I'm hearing his vision of a great work of art. I'm not hearing his rubato in measure 57. And you can't put your finger on anything and say, oh, here he did something clever.
Here he took more time than anybody else. Here he played faster than all the other versions. But you walk out of the performance and you've concentrated for 50 minutes to the degree that you almost have a headache. And you say, my God, what a towering work of art.
And if you ask maniacs who is the better pianist, say Radu Lupu or Andre Watts, here's what he'll tell you.
Good Lord, you can't even say which baseball player is better than another, and that's so full of statistics. You know, it's how do you distinguish at the moment we are Met fans, you know, how do you say who is more valuable to the team, Wally Backman, who's constantly on base, or Gary Carter, who's constantly driving him in? Who is the better artist? Is it Radu Lupu, who plays marvelous Schubert, or is it Andre Watts, who plays marvelous Liszt?
Pianist Emmanuel Ax. You've been listening to Music and the Performer. If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series and information on how to order a cassette of this program, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Thanks to the Smithsonian Folklife Festival and NPR member station WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Our program on Music and the Performer is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. John Widoff is the mix engineer. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. This series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Before we end this program on Music and the Performer, let's consider a special class of performers, musicians who were forced to leave their homeland and move to a radically different environment. The Khmu people from Southeast Asia relocated to Stockton, California. One small but perplexing problem they have is how to replace their bamboo instruments.
It's hard to get the kind of bamboo that she can make the instrument like this, the one that they call jak, they have in Hawaii, but not in here. And she said, in order to keep this kind of instrument work or good sound, she has to keep it moisture. So
she wouldn't have to do that in Laos, right? I mean, no. Why?
No. In Laos, we have a lot of bamboo, so whenever she wants, she just cut the bamboo down and then make it as it dry and throw away and get another one.
But here, how does she do it?
Oh, right here. She has to keep it moisture, so because we don't have bamboo in Stockton.
The Khmu people of Southeast Asia. I'm Lynn Farmer, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.